So this week, we're not going to be talking about a specific book until Thursday. But what I would like to do for the next couple of days is give a few lectures on medieval history, like the big picture of what's going on in like medieval church history, okay? And so today we're going to start with the fall of Rome. I'm going to give you a bigger picture. You've read about the fall of Rome. You've read what Augustine has said about it. But sometimes it's still hard to make heads or tails of what's going on just by reading those primary sources. Right, so I'm going to try to fill in some of those gaps for you. And so I have an outline today that you guys can keep. That'll help you follow along in the lecture. Take one and pass it down. It's front and back. Feel free to take notes on it or just to use it just as a reference point and a guide as I talk. And we'll have time for any questions and answers too. And so in talking about history, the goal here as we study all of these things is not to have an exhaustive understanding of this period in history. We just won't have time. We won't have time to learn everything there is to know about medieval church history or any period of time in history without, you know, lots and lots of study. So we're just doing a 30,000 foot view of all of these things. And so the goal, though, is to have a grasp. I want you as students and as Christians to have a grasp of the major events and especially of the flow of this period of church history in the Middle Ages. And so this word flow, it's a crucial word when we're talking about history. And it's more than just the ability to learn and recite dates and facts and names. I don't really care about that quite so much. To truly study history, though, is to understand the relationship between these things, to understand how one thing led to another in history. And so one big problem, at least in the American mind, collectively, and this includes a large swath of evangelical Christianity, is really the near total lack of awareness of where we came from. You know, not just as a culture, but ecclesiastically as well, like as the church. For many, the church might as well have started with Billy Graham. 20th century. That's really as far back as most Christians these days know church history, or know even the history of Western civilization, or 1776. Well, I don't know anything before 1776. That's a typical American citizen. That's even the typical American Christian. And in fact, many Christians seem to pride themselves on really having no discernible connections to the past. But as Christians, we need to understand why we are where we are and why we are what we are, right? We need to understand these things. And this is useful, of course, for more than just for the sake of the possession of information. If you read, we'll read portions of John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion this year. But if you read Calvin's letter to King Francis in the preface of the Institutes, it's not a very long preface. It's not a very long letter, but it's really interesting in that address that Calvin is defending the Protestant Reformation against the accusations of Rome. And in that, you can actually see his encyclopedic knowledge at work. He's just citing church father after church father in defending the Protestant Reformation, saying, look, we are not something new. We are not some revolutionary new group, we Protestants, that are trying to just blow up everything. No, I know what we are. As a church, I know where we came from. And we all have this history to back us up. And so Calvin had an understanding of where we came from as Christians and why it was legitimate to begin this process of reformation in the church. And so I know you guys have enough reading to do, but I would encourage you to read that. It's online, the Institutes of Christian Religion. I think the Banner of Truth publisher has the letter to King Francis in the front of it. And so I would encourage you to read it. Another thing to think about when it comes to history is the fact that even the Bible itself, by its very nature, demonstrates to us the importance of history, doesn't it? Wouldn't you agree? How do you think the Bible emphasizes history?
It tells the whole thing with a story.
Much of it is historical narrative. Right. Yeah. The Bible is not just a list of doctrines. Right. It's not just do this, don't do that. There's some of that in there. But most of it is historical accounts. The historical accounts of the wonderful works of God in and through history. And so the doctrine comes later on in the New Testament, especially in the New Testament, when the inspired writers interpret these things for us and give us the inspired meaning and significance of all of these things that we've read about in the Old Testament, including most of the historical narrative. And it's much the same thing with church history. We are greatly impoverished as Christians if we don't consider and make ourselves aware of what has come before us. And so I just want to set some parameters for the rest of these this class. This is very important. I care, like I said at the very beginning of humanities when we started, I care a lot less about whether you know, like, you know, facts and dates. I care more about you seeing the connections between the facts and the dates and what's going on spiritually, what's going on politically, what's going on in the church, and how God is moving in his sovereignty, how he has moved throughout history to get us where we are today. And so we're doing that this year with the medieval period of history. And you can see in your outline there the breakdown of the word medieval. It's a compound word. You see a medi and you see ev. And it comes from the Latin words medium and avum, which means middle. And then the next word literally is age. So literally, the Middle Ages. That's what medieval means, the Middle Ages. Now, this of course begs the question, the Middle Ages. Middle of what? What is the Middle Ages in the middle of? Well, can anybody, like, briefly answer that question or give it your best guess? What do you think, Jude?
Rome and, like, the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, that's pretty wide. That's good. Any other? I think the fall of Rome is a good start. The Industrial Revolution, I think, comes. The Industrial Revolution certainly is like a species of this genus. You know, what's the big one? The Renaissance, right? The Renaissance era, like in the, you know, beginning in the 13th, 14th centuries. That's right. And so you have the Roman Empire on one side, and on the other side you have the Renaissance. And for us in particular, as Protestant Christians, on the other side is the Reformation, right? Which comes very closely on the heels of the Renaissance. And so the Middle Ages is the age that lies between the fall of the Roman Empire and then the rebirth, as they call it, the Renaissance. It's what that word means, the rebirth of culture, the rebirth of art and literature that all happened in the Renaissance. And now, for this reason, the Middle Ages is sometimes called the Dark Ages. You've heard that before? The Dark Ages. I don't think it's quite as common to call it the Dark Ages anymore. Certainly in, like, scholarly literature, they're less prone to calling it that. But the reason why many have called this the Dark Ages is because in hindsight, there was a time period that seemingly culture and society had all but collapsed entirely. And contrary to the popular representations of the Middle Ages, this was not primarily a time of magic and wizards and fantasy and knights in shining armor. And, you know, there were knights, but it wasn't the glamorized things that we see today. The Middle Ages was actually a period that was characterized by war, upheaval, national fracturing, invasion, conquest, plague, disease, and lots of death. And the social and the political and the economic stability that Rome had afforded for so many centuries had gone. And in a large sense, it has faded away. Now, this is not to say that the Middle Ages was a time of no significant thought development. Middle Ages is probably one of my favorite time periods of Western civilization because I think it's just the opposite. And I think there was a lot of significant thinking and significant developments in the Middle Ages that I don't think gets the proper credit. I mean, just consider some of the names that we'll be studying further on this year. People like Gregory the Great, Charlemagne. We'll be studying him in a couple of weeks. Anselm, Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas. Who's heard of Thomas Aquinas? I'm sure most of us have. John Wycliffe. He's another famous guy that came from what we would call the Middle Ages. I mean, these were major, major thinkers that really contributed a lot to Christian theology and Christian mission. But by and large, this was a relatively dark time compared to what came before, and especially and compared to what came after. I mean, even one of the Reformation mantras in Latin was post tenebris lux. Anyone know what that means? Post tenebris lux.
After.
Yes.
After.
Do what? Anyone?
Light.
What? Yeah, after darkness, light. After darkness, light. And so even the reformers could agree that there was some darkness in the Middle Ages, right? Now, of course, we have to understand something, that it's historians who, way after the fact, give these kinds of designations to these periods of history. It's historians hundreds of years later that call this time the Dark Ages. The people of the ancient church didn't enter into the year 590 and say, oh, Happy New Year, and we're now in the Middle Ages. That's really not how it works. Martin Luther didn't wake up on October 31st, 1517, and said, you know what, I'm going to start the Reformation today. No, these are designations that came many, many years after the fact, labeled by historians. And so for our purposes, we're going to follow what many church historians label the Christian Middle Ages, which is the years approximately, 590 to 1517. 590, 1517. Now, and so what years did Augustine write? What years was Augustine alive? Anybody remember? Late 300s, that's right. And so we haven't quite come up to this point of 590 yet, although I would argue that Augustine was very much like part of the ramp-up to the Middle Ages. And so fast forward a little bit, in the year 590, when Pope Gregory I, often called Gregory the Great, was appointed Bishop of Rome, and with him, the Roman papacy, as we know it today, really began. Okay, so everything you think of with like the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy and the Vatican and all of that really started to get its stride beginning in 590. And so that's the beginning of what many historians say is the Middle Ages. And of course, that date is debated, but for our purposes, we're going to say 590. Now, 1517, what happened then? Almost 1,000 years later. I just said it. 1517.
The Reformation.
That's right. A Protestant Reformation began. Now, before we talk about the fall of Rome, I just want to say a few things about the importance of studying this period of church history. I've already talked about it a little bit. I just want to point out that as the case would have it, most of us who are familiar with the history of Western civilization are most familiar with two particular areas. The ancient church, which is like, around the birth of the New Testament church. We're quite familiar with the nation of Israel as the church, in the time before Christ. And we're very familiar also with the time of the Reformation onward. That's pretty normal. If Christians know anything about church history, they know mostly about the period before the Reformation or after the Reformation and before the ancient church. All right. And so that period of the Middle Ages, the medieval era, a lot of people don't know about. And so And it makes sense because, you know, most of the monumental developments in the history of Christian church happened during those periods, the ancient church and the Reformation onward. And there's also the fact that we are descendants of the Protestant Reformation, right? Which in itself wasn't something new, but it was the recovery of something that was old and was lost. And as I said a moment ago, Calvin, amongst many others, was reaching back into the ancient church to recover many of the things that were taught and many of the things that were believed in those times from the scriptures. And so we see even the reformers kind of reaching over the medieval period back into the ancient church. And so it makes sense for us Protestants that we are most often familiar with those two eras, the ancient church and the modern church. But we can't forget that the ancient church and the Reformation up to the modern period only covers about half of church history. We're talking about like essentially 1,000 years of our 2,000-year history as the Church of Jesus Christ happens in medieval era, in the Middle Ages. And so a lot of important things happened in that time period, too, that not a lot of people are familiar with. And so whether we like it or not, you know, this is where we came from, and I think we need to know these things. And so by way of introduction, I do want to talk about the fall of Rome now. But before we get into that, do we have any questions or comments while I take a little second to catch my breath? Anything? All right. Well, I did say for our purposes that the Middle Ages began in 590, but I do want to back up a little bit and spend the rest of our time talking about the fall of Rome. And we're going to back up about two centuries before the year 590. And the reason why we're going to talk about the fall of Rome is because this is sort of the warming up period for the Middle Ages. And these are the two centuries before the year 600. These two centuries were kind of like the on-ramp into the Middle Ages. And a lot of significant things happened during this time. And one of the reasons that we have to back up is because when we consider studying history, we have to understand that history is not neat and tidy, okay? History does not divide up neatly and evenly. And so if I were to ask you, for instance, when did the Roman Empire end? That'd be a tricky question to answer, right? In fact, many historians don't agree as to when the Roman Empire ended, because it's a difficult thing to discern. It's much easier to tell when the Roman Empire began. Can anybody tell me about when the the empire began? Not Rome itself, but the empire. When did that begin?
When they crowned Augustus.
When what?
When they crowned Augustus.
That's right, exactly. 27 BC, with the rise of Caesar Augustus to become the sole ruler of Rome. It's very easy to tell when it started. Much more difficult to discern when it ended. And so what I want to do is I'm going to back up all the way to the year 410 AD, okay? 410. Again, about two centuries before 590, the year 410, which brings us back into that ancient church era, kind of overlapping with what we talked about before. Now, in the year 410, for some six centuries, Rome was called the Eternal City. It's called the Eternal City. And it was that city that in the minds of Romans, a city that would never go away. It would never be conquered. It would never fade. It would never be destroyed. And it kind of makes sense why they would think that. I mean, Rome had been a towering world force for a very, very long time. And at this point in the year 410, I mean, it was just a colossal, colossal empire with great, great power. It was too big to fail, like they said about the Titanic. The ship is too big to sink, right? That was the thought about Rome. Rome was the city that was invincible. And all this changed, though, both this reality about Rome and this mindset regarding Rome about being the eternal city, it changed in the year 410. And when a man, as you can see in your outline there, and I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce this, but I'm going to give it a try. His name was Alaric. He laid siege to Rome. Now, he was a leader at that time of this group of people called the Visigoths. And I mentioned just the Goths. That's what I meant. The Visigoths. And now, who were the Visigoths? Well, they were classified by the Romans as barbarians. Now, does anybody know why barbarians were called barbarians? Right. Well, it's kind of like, yeah, it's that. You want to fill that in a little bit?
They thought that the languages that they didn't speak sounded like they were saying bar, bar, bar. They called them barbarians.
Exactly. It was kind of like an onomatopoeia. Like, that's the babbling sound that these tribes made. They from the Romans, they got the name barbarians, right? And so the barbarians were those who did not speak either Greek or Latin. And they also worshipped in large part nature. They worshipped nature. They worshipped nature spirits and trees and all of that sort of stuff. And so they were called by Romans barbarians. And now they mainly, these Visigoths, they mainly inhabited what we would call Northern Europe. And they had already had interactions with Rome. And they had at this point in the year 410... something of a strained relationship with Rome. And so they weren't exactly on good terms with Rome. They themselves, the Visigoths, feared back in the 300s of being conquered by another group called the Ostrogoths. And so they actually petitioned Rome in the 300s to move across the Danube River into Roman territory so that they could be protected by the Roman Empire. And Rome said, yes, you can do that. But then after they crossed into Roman territory, the Romans actually viciously mistreated the Visigoths, which really enraged them. And so Alaric, in the year 395, had already conquered Athens by that point. And so in the year 410, he sat outside the gates of Rome with his army, and he eventually sacked Rome. And the interesting thing about Alaric is that he claimed to be a Christian. One thing that you'll learn if you study more about this is that one of the things that led to some tensions between Rome and these Germanic tribes is the fact that although many of these Germanic tribes claimed to be Christians, they were very heavily influenced by Arianism. If that's an ancient heresy. Can someone like briefly explain Arianism? If you're an Arian, what are you? Athanasius talks about Arianism at length in his book on the Incarnation. If you remember reading that way back when. Arianism. No one? Come on, come on. Yeah? Well, do what?
You see God in nature.
No. Let me try to help you. Jehovah's Witnesses are what you would classify as Arians, Arianism. What is the distinction between Christianity and Jehovah's Witnesses?
Jesus is God's son.
Well, who believes that?
Biologically.
Right. So, what is if Jesus is God's son? I explain that more. That's not
God
really.
God made Jesus.
God made. Bingo. Exactly. Jesus is a created being. So therefore, Jesus is not God. He was a good teacher, but he was not God. So that is the typical argument in Arianism. They believe that he was maybe a semi-divine, less than God creature. And so these tribes were very heavily influenced by this theology of Arianism. And now at this point, the Western world, as they sacked Rome, would never be the same again. It changed everything in the year 410. Now, as we think about the year 410, what major church history figure was alive in the year 410? We mentioned him a few minutes ago. Augustine, that's right. Or Augustine, however you want to pronounce his name. I don't really care. Some historians are huge sticklers about how you pronounce his name. I do not care. It's Augustine or Augustine, however you want to pronounce it. Now, it was actually this event of the sack of Rome that inspired, as you know, as you just got finished reading his colossal work on this, it inspired Augustine to write The City of God. And just to give a quick recap, The City of God, Augustine sought to address the Roman people as to why Rome had seemingly fallen. Think about it. Again, we talked about this, but it's worth reminding you. Think about this nation, this city, this empire that has stood for over 600 years unchallenged, now being sacked by the Visigoths. What kind of distress would this lay upon the Roman people? And Augustine was writing really to the Roman people, explaining to them why these things happened. And he described how the city of man, of which the Empire of Rome is a part, is temporal. And the only city that is eternal, the only city that will never actually fade away, is the city of God, which is beyond brick and mortar walls. And now for Augustine, what characterized the city of man is what? We talked about this almost ad nauseum. What was the main characteristic of the city of man, the earthly city? Self-love, that's right. Self-love, self-glory, right? Think the Tower of Babel. What characterizes the city of God and its glory?
Love of God.
Yes, that's exactly right. Is the glory of God and the love for God. Now, his explanation for why Rome had fallen is because, well, one of the reasons is because, like the city of man, Rome has become highly immoral. It's become immoral. You see the moral decline and the decay of the Roman Empire as it comes towards its end. And Roman culture had, at this point, become increasingly sexually deviant and murderous and very barbaric. Roman emperors themselves were sometimes outrageously immoral. And the wealth of Rome's early and middle years had become, in many ways, just pure decadence. And so this is very clearly God's chastisement of Rome, not only as Augustine would say, but also other major figures like Pope Leo later on would say that. And so just for your consideration here, just to kind of tie it to the present day, Francis Schaeffer, in his book, How Shall We Then Live, talks about differing signs that a society is decaying, right? And if I remember correctly, he references the Roman Empire there, and he lists a few things. And I just want you to think with me for a second, just kind of soberly, these things that he mentions, these indicators that society is well on its way to its downfall. What are some things that he mentions? We talked about this a little bit. What is the sign of a downfall of civilization? What is one of them?
Heavy taxation.
We'll talk about that. Yeah. A mounting love of show and luxury. We'll start there. Very decadent, very showy of your luxury. And, you know, just think about the pomp of Rome for a minute. He mentions a widening gap between the rich and the poor. It's another indicator. He mentions an obsession with sex. And he mentions the freakishness in the arts masquerading as originality. If you look at early Roman art versus later Roman art, you can see some of that, right? Now, of course, it isn't as grotesque as some of the things that we see today, like the cross of Christ and a jar of urine. But you can see some of that degradation in Rome. And now that it was the year 410, Alaric sacks Rome by God's chastisement, right? And only 40 years later, in the year 452, Italy suffered another great siege, this time from Attila the Hun. And now the Huns were a nomadic people who were mainly concentrated in modern-day Romania, Serbia, Hungary, Austria, Slovakia. So you can think of all the areas like immediately north of Greece. And as Attila the Hun approached Rome, he sat outside the gates, much like Alaric did 40 years earlier. And it's interesting because this is the first time that a negotiator actually comes out to out of Rome to negotiate with Attila. Okay. And does anybody know who that was? Who was the negotiator? It was actually Pope Leo I. It was a pastor. It was a bishop of the church. And he ended up negotiating with Attila. And he said, please spare the city. And Attila agreed. And he did spare the city, although he and his soldiers did wreck a lot of the rest of Italy. And now some 3 years after this, in the year 455, Rome was again, and you can just see this repeated attack upon Rome really weakened it over time. Rome was again threatened by a new enemy, this time the Vandals. The Vandals. Now, the Vandals were another Germanic tribe, originally occupied what is now modern-day Poland, but they were for a time actually expelled from Europe. And when they were expelled, they settled in North Africa, in the area of Carthage. And now think about this. Think about the world map in your head of that area, the Mediterranean Sea there, and consider how close North Africa is to Rome. It's very close. I mean, it's just a quick sail over the Mediterranean Sea and you're at Rome. All right. And now imagine having this group of people who is now an enemy, and now a frustrated enemy, who has been expelled from Europe, kicked out of Europe, being at your back door. And this was the political and military situation of Rome at that time. So in 455, the Vandals, led by a man named, again, there's so many names here, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, but I'm going to try, led by a man named Gaiseric. And in his leadership, the Vandals, in 455, struck Rome. Now, I'm just going to read an excerpt of here, and you can see on the back of your outline, one of the books I recommend is Church History in Plain Language by Bruce Shelley. Great book. It's a really helpful book. And I'm just going to read a little section about this event from that book. He says, at the end of March 455, Gaiseric, king of the Vandals, set sail with 100 ships manned by Carthaginian sailors. His army landed north of the Tiber, creating panic in Rome, and rumors swirled that Gaiseric intended to burn the city. Many tried to flee. The imperial troops mutinied. While attempting to escape, the emperor Maximus was slain by one of his own bodyguards. His body was dragged through the streets, torn to pieces, and thrown into the river. No general took over the defense. The troops were disorganized. And so, on June 2nd, 455, the Vandals entered Rome, meeting no resistance. And so this was a significant, significant event in Rome's history. And again, a man came out to negotiate with the Vandals to try to spare the city. Guess who that was? Pope Leo again. He's back out there trying to save Rome. And he ended up being a very significant figure in the sparing of Rome. And so Gaiseric agreed to leave Rome, but only after 14 days of looting and destroying what he could of the city. Okay, so after a fairly horrendous 2 weeks, the Vandals took their loot and went back to Carthage to take their money to the bank, I suppose. Now, in response to the Vandals leaving, in very Augustinian fashion, Pope Leo actually addressed the city of Rome, and he said this. I'm going to have to paraphrase. It's pretty lengthy. He addressed the city of Rome just like Augustine did, and he said, look, the world is not ended just because these Vandals came in and wrecked part of our city. This is very clearly God's chastisement of us. It's his discipline. And so the proper response should be that we should give thanks to the Lord that the Vandals have left, and that they have spared the city, that God has spared the city from total destruction, and we need to repent. He gave a proclamation of repentance, and we need to turn back to God. And so that was his message. And so the Vandals obviously did great damage to Rome. That's where we get the term vandalism from, is from this tribe of people called the Vandals. And so now at this, we arrive at the year when many historians say that the Roman Empire finally fell. And that is the year 476. Now, by this point, you can well see the Roman Empire had suffered a better part of a century, both of societal decay and of great military defeat, humiliating military defeat, and demoralizing. And so Rome was a very demoralized city. There wasn't much hope left in the glory of Rome. And because of all of this interaction with these Germanic tribes, these barbarian tribes, at this point in the year 476, much of Rome's military leadership was actually of Germanic descent. And so politically and in terms of military, these Germanic peoples actually wielded a significant amount of power, not just outside of Rome like they did before, but now actually within Rome, they're wielding lots of power. And so you can see in your outline there, in the year 475, a Germanic leader of the Roman troops, again, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Orestes, he actually forced the Senate in 475 to elect his son, or to appoint his son, Romulus Augustulus, to be emperor of Rome. And he used his military strength to force the Senate's hand. And then a year after that, in 476, another Germanic imperial leader, Odovacar, actually kills Orestes and has his son, Romulus Augustus, deposed. And just like that, the line of Roman emperors ceases. And this is why many historians point to the year 476 as the fall of the Roman Empire. And now before we get into, like, so what? Like, why is this important? Does anybody have any questions so far? No? All right. Well, of course, we've covered, you know, a century or so in 30 minutes. That's why I ended up bringing up what Francis Schaeffer said, because he was actually, he was writing that for the purpose of kind of analyzing American culture. We can use this decadent, sunset of Roman culture to analyze our own culture. And many people have pointed that out, that the degradation of the Roman Empire, we see a lot of the same things happening in our own society today, especially with an obsession with sex. This is a society, the one we live in. I mean, I don't think there's any other society in anyone's memory that has had this much obsession with sexual deviancy as ours has. But also, I thought it was really interesting that Schaeffer brought out the degradation represented in art, the grotesqueness of art being masqueraded as originality. Another thing that Schaeffer mentions that I didn't mention here, because I don't know if this happened in Rome, another thing he mentioned as a sign of the coming fall of society is the increasing dependence of a populace upon the state. We are much like that. We depend upon the state far more than what we realize. And so I'll just leave that there. All right. Well, what time is it? We have a few more minutes. Let's finish our time here asking the question, so what? Why is all this important? Again, history is not just the recitation and the learning of facts, but we want to understand, especially for our purposes, what this has to do with the church, right? You'll notice that I haven't really talked about the church much, except just mentioning the courage of Leo, Pope Leo, to deal with the Vandals and Attila the Hun, and to beg for the sparing of Rome. And so we ask the question, so what? What does this have to do with Western civilization? What does this have to do with church history? And so I want to end our time today by giving you a few things to consider. The first is the fact that the fall of Rome left a massive power vacuum with the deposition of Romulus Augustulus. And so there wasn't a proper emperor after he was deposed to occupy the seat of power in Rome. So there was a power vacuum that someone needs to fill in order for Rome to continue. The necessity arose for someone to exercise leadership over the empire. Because while the Roman Empire, as it once was, fell, really in 476, the vestiges of the Roman Empire still endured pretty much until 1806, when Napoleon finally done away with it, with the Holy Roman Empire. Right? But with this power vacuum here, there is a necessity for somebody to kind of be the head over the West. Who do you think would rise to fill that vacuum? Huh? The papacy. That's right. The papacy. The church would in large part rise to fill that power vacuum. And the unifying entity at this point that really held Europe together was the Christian religion in its various expressions, heretical, Arian, or otherwise. Just to quote a story in here, he said it was. Bob Godfrey. I don't have him on your reading on that suggested reading, but he says he basically says that the Middle Ages were essentially one grand experiment in Christian civilization. It's an experiment, Christendom 1.0, right? The fall of Rome essentially allowed the church to begin to reconstruct European civilization according to the Christian religion instead of Roman culture and history. And so this gives rise to the papacy as now the bishop of Rome, not just of the church, but now the bishop of Rome, the empire. That office had been around for centuries at this point, but the papacy as we come to know it and as we would come to understand it as it was expressed, especially as things came to head around the Reformation, really began to have its seeds planted in around this time in the year 600. And of course, we'll look at that in due time later on. But that's the first thing to remember is that the fall of Rome left this massive power vacuum that needed to be filled. And it would be filled in large part by the papacy. Secondly, the fall of Rome opened the way for Christian expansion in Europe. Of course, there had already been some missionary efforts in Europe. There had been missionary endeavors in Spain, in Gaul. There had been efforts even in the Germanic tribes of Northern Europe. There had been missionary efforts in the British Isles. And you think of, I think I'm remembering this correctly, the other Saint Augustine. I don't know if you remember him. The Saint Augustine who was a missionary to Britain. The Venerable Bede talks about him a lot in his Ecclesiastical History of the English People. And so that was happening. But the invasion of these pagans from the north inspired even greater missionary efforts to these Germanic barbarian tribes. And we'll look at that in the future, especially with the rise of Pope Gregory in 590. Pope Gregory the Great, as he was called, he was a monastic, especially, and with his rise, you have this proliferation of monasteries. Now, if you know anything about medieval church history, medieval history, one of the primary vehicles for the spread of Christianity, for the spread of the Christian scriptures, for the preservation of the Christian scriptures, for the translation of the scriptures, were monasteries. Okay? Monasteries with monks in them. And of course, we would have many disagreements with what Luther called monkery. But we owe, and we'll talk about this in a future session, but for now, we do owe a great deal to the monastic movement for the Christianization of the West and the preservation of the scriptures in the West. And so that's another thing to consider is how the fall of Rome opened the way for Christian expansion into Europe. But thirdly and finally, as we end things today, the fall of Rome really changed the landscape of Christendom. It really changed the landscape. We're shifting our focus here to Western circumstances and events. Not only do you have that divide between the East and the West, we haven't talked about the East at all, which is this divide, which is already felt in the ancient church and just really continued to intensify into the year 1054. But you also now have this political and ecclesiastical divide between the North and the South. In Europe, which would actually continue, and the effects of this would continue to be felt even through the Reformation. I mean, you think about the landscape of Europe during the Reformation, even in countries like Germany, where even now you have South Germany being largely Catholic, Roman Catholic, and then North Germany being mostly Lutheran. You still see this landscape playing out on throughout the rest of church history. And so that'll be become significant as well. There's obviously a lot more things we can say about all this, but this is just kind of getting us into the mindset of what's going on historically in Europe at this time that leads to the events that we're going to study and the books that we're going to read in medieval history. Any more questions or comments? Anything? Now's your chance. Okay. All right. Well, some of the things that Augustine said in City of God, in Confessions, and all of his writings, he said, a brilliant man as he is, there were some things he said that just weren't great, you know, and they weren't heretical or, but a lot of people read Augustine and took some of the things that he said to a bad extreme. Okay. I think his ecclesiology, like his study of the church, could use some work. I mean, who am I to judge? I'm just a lowly pastor in Acadiana. But I would agree with a lot of other great men who have read Augustine extensively and said that maybe he was still developing his ecclesiology as he was writing City of God. And so many of Augustine's doctrines of the church had been taken to a very nasty extreme by Roman Catholics, and Augustine, and due to his what he's written in City of God and how it was interpreted, this is how we got the Roman Catholic Church as we see it today. And so some people blame Augustine for that. Maybe he just hadn't fleshed it out all the way yet. He seems very Protestant, though, when I read him. He wouldn't call himself a Protestant. He wouldn't know what that is, but he seems very orthodox, and he is. He really is. But some of the things he said, you know how when you like try to tell someone something and you're trying to be very careful that it's a very sensitive subject, but so you try to like form the words just right so there's like the least amount of misunderstanding, but then they still misunderstand it. I think that's what's happening here. I think he tried his best, but I think some church leaders misunderstood him and took some things to the extreme, and we'll see that later on. We'll also see throughout our time in medieval history a power struggle between the church and the state. There's plenty of that going on, and you're going to see, depending on who has more supremacy, you're going to see the church in the more conservative position. And so that struggle, which really didn't happen in the east kind of stayed out of all that, and that's something that's wired the history's between the East and the West are so different. And we'll talk about that in the future too. But we're primarily going to talk about the West because that's where our heritage is. And so as we wrap up, I think it's very important for you, as you think about the fall of Rome, to think that, not to think that that was just an incidental thing, an incidental event that has no significance in not only history of the world, but in God's like sovereign plans. I really think the fall of Rome is a direct fulfillment of the prophecy that Daniel saw when the rock that was cut out without hands smashed all the kingdoms of the world, right? Of course, Christ did that, right? Christ did that when in his incarnation, when he came and when he did his atoning work and when he is in his session, ascended to the right hand of the Father. He certainly did that. But we can begin to see how Christ is starting to topple all of these kingdoms of the world, including the feet of iron and clay, which is the Roman Empire. And so it's actually God's judgment on Rome. And we got to be careful not to read into the rise of the church at that time, the current evils and the current stupidity of the Roman Catholic Church, okay? We can't immediately think the church back then like what we would consider the Roman Catholic Church, looks exactly like the church as we see it now. We have to be careful of that, okay? But it's really good to situate all of this in just remembering, like, this is God doing exactly what he said he was going to do. Okay, so the fall of Rome is a part of God's plan. And without the fall of Rome, we couldn't see any of the other wonderful things that God has done throughout the course of the rest of history, which lead us primarily, us here to this day, learning about this and the society we're learning about it in, right? And so, all right, I think that's about it for today. Okay, you guys are dismissed.